to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine and next it's black. So if you want me off your back, well come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now?
Hello everyone. This is Mitch Belgian
and Shelley Menalasino here with The Deciding Mind.
We got a great show for you today.
Yes, you know, we've been doing the last year and a half seeking out various experts to help us explore that curious thing we all do, make decisions. Many of our old shows you can find on our archive for your casual listening. You know, we started with the first two shows with a decision analyst, and who is actually a failure expert.
But don't call him a failure. He's an expert at failure.
Yes, I guess that's true.
You might be listening.
And we went on to explore topics like what happens to our decisions when we're in groups. And we interviewed a neuroeconomist and a few psychoanalysts about narcissism. And actually, mostly, we've been exploring a lot of topics with leading neuroscientists, one who we're going to talk to today.
Yeah, it seems we've gotten addicted to neuroscience. I'm not quite sure how this happened, but maybe that's the way things work. Actually, I'm sure you're all going to be very glad to hear there's another conference coming up in October. This one's going to be in New Orleans, so we're going to have to go down a few days early and get some jambalaya and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm sure we're going to have a stack of new and exciting information for how your neurons are almost functioning correctly.
And for the nerds out there in our audience. So today, as you all know, is the Sustaining Membership Drive.
And by the way, we come proudly from not only Hudson, Catskill, and Acre, but also Cornwallville, New York. Everybody say yay for Cornwallville.
Yay.
It's a little town on the map, but we're getting big, really big.
All right.
So anyway, we have...
So you could donate, actually, by going on online. And the Sustaining Membership, wanted to say something about that?
Sustaining Membership is the way to go. You don't even see it go. It goes right out of your credit card, $5, $10, $15, $20, or $50,000, whatever you want to do a month. $50,000 is the preferred amount, if you can.
And it allows the really sustaining capacity at the radio station, so... We hope that's the purpose of this small drive, and in the fall there'll be a larger pledge drive.
So please get ready to do that. We know a number of people who are sustaining members. You hardly see it. It just goes to the station, allows us to operate continuously without asking you for money, and then you feel as if you're part of the community.
Yes, and it allows the programmers to really focus on making good radio for you. So this interview is about 50 minutes, and we'll be here if you want to call in with donation or with a sustaining membership. Otherwise, we'll be back at the end of the interview.
Thank you very much. Hold on to your seats. It's a rocky ride. This is Mitch Belgian.
And Shelley Menalasino.
For The Deciding Mind, we're here at Vassar College with Dr. Abigail Baird. We met Dr. Baird at the Society for Neuroscience 2011 annual meeting. And she presented a talk on the adolescent brain. Dr. Baird, can you tell us your titles here at the university?
Sure. I'm a professor of psychology in the Department of Psychology, Vassar. I'm also a Vassar alum, which is something I'm very proud of. I was briefly for 5 years, I was a professor at Dartmouth prior to being at Vassar. And prior to Dartmouth, I was at Harvard. I was very lucky in graduate school. I studied with Jerome Kagan, who is a brilliant developmental psychologist, and I've never met a scientist like Jerry, just absolutely brilliant and so driven about his science. And then leaving and going to do a postdoc at Dartmouth, where I eventually ended up being faculty, but I went as a postdoc to work with Mike Gazzaniga, who started the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, who's also mind-blowingly brilliant and, again, a fantastic mentor. So I've been really, really lucky in terms of working with people who have let me create the stuff that I'm interested in and let me pursue things that, actually, not unlike, you know, raising a teenager, both would kind of look at me and nod and be like, well, I hope that works. I'm not sure, but you have my support.
Can you tell us what you focus your studies on?
I mean, I think before I say anything about my own work, it's really important to comment on the fact that the reason I got into this was because I actually was pursuing a degree in clinical psychology, and I was working with a lot of schizophrenic and bipolar young adults who were having their first episodes. And I got really frustrated that we didn't know why. And it was fascinating to me that a lot of them, particularly the males, seemed to be seniors in high school, freshmen in college, and seemed to be sort of at the tail end of puberty. So I thought, okay, it must be something about adolescence. So I'll just go figure out what happens during adolescence, and then I can cure schizophrenia, and that'll be great. So I went to the literature, and this was probably 1994, 95. Which is weird because I'm only, you know, 22. There's just nothing. There's absolutely nothing. Besides, maybe Jay Geed's work was out by then. But what I realized was we really didn't know what typical development looked like in adolescence. So I started there. And it's because of, you know, a handful of scientists who have consistently put out amazing work. And so the piece of the pie in terms of understanding adolescent cognitive and emotional development, the piece that I study, it's really important to see it in context, particularly when it comes to talking about decision making. For example, adolescents are notoriously impulsive, and BJ Casey and Bea Luna are two scientists who have studied impulsivity and frontal lobe development in adolescents. And
which kind of development?
Frontal lobe.
Frontal lobe.
Prefrontal cortex, which is the stuff under your forehead. And it's the last part of the brain to develop. And there are lots of good reasons for that. It basically waits to develop because it's the part of your brain that's most you. Born immature because humans vary so much in the culture that they exist and in the rules that accompany their cultures. So I think of adolescent development very much the way that most people think of language development. There are a lot of capacities for things. There aren't a lot of hardwired things. So, you know, we're not born speaking a language. We're born with the capacity to learn language. And I think adolescence has a great parallel in terms of social knowledge. We're born with the capacity to learn all of the skills that we need to have to become an adult in the society that we're going to live. But we don't come with those skills. We have to learn them. So given that we have to learn them, a part of the brain has to hang around to help us do that. And so the prefrontal cortex, which is basically the brain's coordinator, a lot of people talk about it as the brain's executive or the brain's conductor. It's an integrator. It works with just about every part of the brain, and its biggest function is it produces behavior. No behavior comes out of a human unless the frontal cortex has something to do with it, which is why lobotomies were so popular. I was going to say, and maybe still are in some places. If you disconnect the frontal lobe in a human being, you will get no behavior. No behavior comes out of a human without the frontal lobe's involvement. So young children have frontal lobes. Young children are capable of regulating their behavior. But young children, three, 4, 5-year-olds, get tired really fast. And when they get tired, how do we know they're tired? Well, they have trouble regulating their emotion, and they don't behave well, and they say things, right, and they tantrum. Well, what happens when adults get really, really tired? The same thing. It just takes more for them to get tired because their frontal lobes are more mature.
So when you say frontal lobe, you're talking about the circuits, right? I mean, we refer to it as if it's below our forehead, but it's really the brain's all these circuits, right?
I'm so glad you said that, because perhaps one of the greatest misunderstandings about brain development is that stuff just grows. Like, right. You know, like you don't have a frontal lobe, and now all of a sudden you're getting a frontal lobe.
And you get older.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. The brain, basically, by the time you're 5, has its fixed size. But what happens is it improves its coordination, its circuitry. And there is a use-or-lose policy, and there is a, you know, sort of paying the tolls policy. So circuits that get used a lot are well-maintained. Circuits that don't get used are not maintained. And one of the things that happens during adolescence is there is an awakening of areas speaking to each other that perhaps didn't speak to each other prior to adolescence. There's a big debate as to whether new connections are formed or if it's just that connections that have been dormant get tapped for the first time in development. But what happens is that the brain becomes more coordinated, becomes more efficient, more skilled at the things that are demanded of it. Demands of the environment shape how the brain's going to function. which is really handy. A very easy example of this is eye gaze. So,
is
you know,
what?
Eye gaze. So looking eye people gaze. In the eye. So you can't see this because it's an audio interview, but as I'm speaking to you, I'm looking at you. And in our society, that's polite. But there are a lot of societies where that's not polite. And actually, as you probably both know, if you want to get a dog to bite you, one of the easiest ways to do that is to stare at them directly in the eye. It's a very aggressive thing to do in a lot of cultures. So if I were in Thailand right now, I'd be being very rude to you by looking at you directly. So thankfully, I have a frontal lobe that, as I was growing up in the United States, followed the social cues of, we look at each other to say, I'm paying attention to you, you matter to me, I'm following. But somewhere else, that might not be what that communicates. So in order to do that, in order to learn that, you have to have circuits that aren't finished, that are waiting for more information and that are adaptable. And that's why, you know, basically, if you want to know the piece of your brain that is the most you, it's that frontal lobe. It's the last piece to sort of coordinate. And it never really stops changing. I mean, well, when you're dead, it probably stops, but pretty much up until then.
So that is also the area that one might consider, when we say decision-making, I think maybe perhaps the other term to use is choice. Decision-making sounds like this very rational construct, but as we are developing, we're facing choices all the time. It's a simpler concept than decisions, I think. Animals make choices too, correct?
Yes.
And so animals have prefrontal cortexes that just not as well developed.
Yeah.
Varying degrees. And so prefrontal cortex and our ability to use it is what makes us more human, and some humans more human than others, perhaps.
Yeah. Yes, and if you want to come back next year, I can talk to you about my other research on elephants, who are also very good decision-makers.
I'm always planning on returning to college.
I'm studying their decision-making abilities right now as well, in terms of their social bonds and social memory. The frontal lobe, again, is the conductor. I'm someone in science who is not a big believer in dogma. So I will offer you my opinion, but I will also encourage you or anyone who's listening to consider other points of view on this, because we don't know for sure. I'm of the mind that the frontal lobe actually doesn't do a whole lot of decision making. I'm much more primitive. I'm a big believer in sort of the gut sense, the accumulation of experiences. I don't think dogma in science is useful, period. So I haven't run into anything that I feel comfortable saying 100%, this is how this works, and you can count on it always get working this way. I feel strongly, but I don't feel like I can prove to you, but I feel strongly that most decisions, the vast majority of our decisions, are made based on our prior experience, and they're made very quickly, which is an evolutionary model. So that's in keeping with this idea that we have to make decisions quickly because our lives may depend on it. And you might not think about taking a job in Seattle as being your life depending on that, but actually it does. It's just a very removed, it's 3, 4, 5 steps removed. If you lose all your friends and job doesn't work out, or it's too far away for you to feel confident and comfortable, then you might actually lose your life in some way. So I think humans are incredible decision makers. I think we make it very quickly based on a lot of gut. Some people might call it intuition, some people might call it a gut sense, but I think it's based on experience. And so I think this is one of the reasons that teenagers run into trouble. They start traveling in circles and environments, and particularly, you know, they start practicing being adults where they're exposed to decision-making that they haven't had to deal with before. The best adolescents, when they don't get a gut feeling of what they should do, my data would say they actually think about it, which is what we would like them to do. We would like them to think about it and practice until they get it right. The trouble is, in a lot of the things we worry about the most, sometimes you don't get a second chance, you know? So driving a car 90 miles an hour, if you hit a tree, that you don't get a second decision on that one, which is one of the reasons why I think it's so important for children and young adolescents to get as much experience in as many different ways as possible, which is why helicopter/jet fighter, and I think the new word is Velcro parents who completely encircle their children, I think is a very potentially dangerous way to raise children, to sort of limit their experiences or have their experiences for them. Right. And one of the things that we don't do right now, we don't have a lot of low-cost mistakes for teenagers. If you look at the juvenile justice system, I mean, stuff that in the 1800s, when I was a kid, you know, you got into trouble in your neighborhood and the neighbors would call your folks, or, you know, they'd give you the hairy eyeball and you're like, oh, in my neighborhood, is Mrs. Delvecchio was always on her porch and it was like, you're going to get in trouble. But, you know, no one was going to call the police. Not that calling the police is bad. There's obviously certain instances when the police should be involved. But the way that kids' lives can so quickly turn on a dime now, you know, if you get arrested, I was reading recently, you know, you can get arrested in Connecticut for spray painting, graffiti, at 16. If you're 16, you go into adult prison for graffiti.
Wow.
That will change your life for good, mm-hmm. even if it's just a night or two. So that's a pretty high penalty, pretty high cost for a kind of silly, typical mistake that a kid might make, trying something out, you know. So teenagers try stuff out. They take risks. They're pre-programmed to try to take risks. Their impulses are stronger than kids and stronger than adults because it's a time in life where your biology is cueing you to get up and go and try new things and seek out new things, particularly males. Not, again, not universally males. There are some females who get the same get up and go signal.
Get up and go.
Get up and go. So in every species, when the species hits reproductive age, when they become reproductively viable, one sex has to disperse to avoid incest, to keep the gene pool fresh. So in just about every species, it's the sex that's bigger and stronger because they stand a better chance of getting farther. And so in most primates and non-human primates, it's the males, and with thus it's the males as well. And there have actually been some really cool studies done with non-human primates looking at how far male monkeys have gotten from their maternal area that they were brought up in, and the farther they get, the more reproductively successful they are. Why? Well, because they didn't pay much attention to setbacks, which means they were immune to punishment, which a lot of adolescent boys, human boys also are. They had a high sense of interest in novelty and sensation seeking, which we also know a lot of adolescent boys are. And they probably were rooted on by their peers for trying to go farther and do more, which adolescent boys often are. So there is, to get down to the nitty gritty, basically testosterone interacts with dopamine. And both of those guys have a big stake in the basal ganglia, which literally is movement, but also has a lot to do with initiation of not only movements, but thoughts and all sorts of things. And it makes boys, and again, some girls, but largely boys, want to try new stuff. And their reward system also gets cranked up because, again, because of dopamine, largely dopamine. And there's some really cool new work that's come out recently about how sensitive the reward systems in adolescents are, which makes perfect sense because there are so many setbacks. There are so many things to be learned. And you have to learn so much so fast that if you took every setback to heart, I don't know if you'd get out of bed.
Huh. Well, then there are those adolescents that something goes wrong and they then become really avoidant.
Right.
And their lives sort of shrink rather than...
Yep.
They don't take the risk to...
Right. So the other thing that often gets overlooked is, and perhaps this is, you know, the effects of being mentored by Jerry Kagan, but I believe very much in temperament. And if you've had more than one child or ever been around more than one newborn infant, you know that temperament is a very real thing. If you've been around animals, you know that temperament is a real thing. I think temperament, I really like Kagan's definition, his basic definition, sort of reactivities. For a long time, he was really not interested in the brain. I think he sort of, over the years become more comfortable talking about the brain. And I think he would sort of place a lot of emphasis on the arousal system as regulated pretty much by the amygdala, by the fight or flight. So how easy is it for me to kick you into fight or flight mode? And that he's seen in children, and he now has imaged these people in their 20s, that they have a more sensitive amygdala all the way through their development. Now, how that plays out behaviorally, and this is one of the beautiful things about human beings and one of the amazing things about neuroscience, how it plays out developmentally and behaviorally could be anything. So there are these 20-year-olds who still have kind of hypersensitive amygdalas, an easy fight or flight response, but behaviorally they might not show it because they've learned to regulate themselves. There are big sex differences in reactivity. So I think inhibition to the unfamiliar, which is what Kagan would say, is a very excellent way to capture a big chunk of human temperament, because there are children who are tentative, easy to upset, shy, the watchers, from the get-go.
Right.
And you worry less about them because they aren't going to take risks. But then you start to worry more about them because they need to take some risk in life, you know, because not you can't sit back and watch everything. But you worry a little less because you're like, okay, you're not the kid that's going to climb up on the roof that I have to worry about. But you are the kid I have to worry about because you're not going to try anything. Yeah, and you got to go.
You might get this experience.
And you need that experience. You need that experience to be a successful adult.
I would imagine that also would be not a very good achiever. Well, depends what they're talking about in terms of achievement.
Right. I was going to say, because a lot of those kids are the kids who also love to stay inside and read books and have very rich internal lives. And, you know, reading about something scary is very different than doing something scary. So they may be enormously successful academically because they're not interested in being outside and tackling each other and building forts and doing more active or potentially dangerous stuff. So
was the focus of your presentation at the Society for Neuroscience, if I'm not mistaken, was this concept that adolescents have a different decision approach than adults,
mm-hmm.
and that adults are basically maddened by watching adolescents making decisions and what the decisions are based on.
Right. So I think one of the things that I often say when I talk about that data set is there's this parental mantra when teenagers get into trouble, you know, what were you thinking?
Right.
And as I like to say, my mother always inserted in God's name in the middle there. What in God's name were you thinking? Yeah. And if you ask teenagers after they've done something that we don't understand as adults, you know, what were you thinking? A lot of them can't answer you. They really can't. And a lot of parents take this as being disrespectful, being avoidant. I think they really don't know. So I was thinking about this when I was working with teenagers, and it had come up in a couple of other instances, and I was like, you know, I think they actually really don't know why they do these things. So I came up with a really, really simple idea to ask them questions. Just ask them really simple questions about whether or not they thought certain things were a good idea.
Oh, right. At the conference, you even presented a little,
yeah, little, a little snippet. So they went into the MRI machine. I had 25 adults, 25 kids, and they went in. And I watched their brains, both the adults and the adolescents, and all they saw was a white screen with a phrase on it. And they had to decide yes or no if it was a good idea. And there were some things that were very obviously fine ideas, like eating a salad or walking the dog or reading the newspaper. And then there were other things that were obviously less good ideas, like lighting your hair on fire or drinking Drano or swimming with sharks or jumping off a roof. And what was really cool was everybody got 100% correct. So the adults and the teenagers all correctly identified the safe versus dangerous stuff. So adolescents know. They know that these things are not good ideas. You know, this could lead us on a tangent of how we message teenagers. Because a lot of times people think, oh, if I just explain it to them, they won't do it. But that's not the problem. They do understand. They understand stuff. It's that they don't do it. So why don't they do it? So what we found was they got the answers right, but they actually took much longer. They were very similar in terms of the reaction time and the time it took them to answer. Very similar to adults on the safe ideas. But for the dangerous ideas, the adolescents took way longer, much more significantly longer. And
how long does it take you to think of not burning your hair?
I mean, I was looking at the data and I was like, wait, really? 300 milliseconds, which is, that's a car accident. It doesn't sound like a long time, but 300 milliseconds in the brain is a long time. And I was like, lighting your hair on fire. What are you thinking about? And that actually was very informative to me because I was like, wait, I'm not thinking. I'm not thinking about it. I don't have to think about it. I just know.
Right.
Well, what is just know? What does that mean to just know something? Well, it's long-term memory. But it also turns out that when it comes to dangerous stuff, we have this really cool system as adults that relies heavily on the amygdala, the fight or flight response, and heavily on something called the insula, which reads our body state. And our memory kicks in and throws us a whole bunch of information really, really fast.
It's and like our things like disgust, right?
Yeah, that's exactly insula? Right. Yes. That feeling in your gut of something's... Ugh. So you don't actually have to think about how that would play out. You just hear it and you're like, no, something in there is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like if you ask someone, hey, go over there and steal that guy's wallet. Most people just look at you like you're nuts and they don't think about it. They just, they know that that's not okay.
Some people would ask how much money is in that wallet.
Those would be younger males.
Uh-huh.
Some older males. It's interesting that you asked me that question.
And this is actually a big topic in decision making, whether you should be driven by your gut response or.
Right.
And so this is not a small little arena of discussion.
Which is exactly why I said, like, I'm offering my viewpoint. I don't think we know the answer yet. I think adults use a lot of the cognitive stuff, the thinking stuff. I think a lot of us use that to actually explain to ourselves why our gut made the decision it made.
I agree.
And we use that cognitive brilliant. I mean, we're great thinkers and we're great reasoners. And I think when we say rationalize, it makes it sound like we're trivializing the decision. And I don't believe that that's what's happening. I think we're actually explaining to ourselves why we made the decision we made, which is very different from... It's almost patronizing to be like, oh, you made the decision, now you're just rationalizing it. No, you made a decision that you didn't quite understand because it happened so quickly based on such an amalgamation of your experience that now you need a little time to process it.
Or to even communicate it
right.
to somebody else.
Absolutely.
But I think one of the questions that enters into that dilemma is, are we learning from our experiences or are we just making sure we don't blame ourselves or take the responsibility for a bad decision? And that gets very complicated.
It does, but I think when you're growing up, I mean, one of the things that adolescents are not great at is abstract thought. And so one of the things that helps people mature is the ability to learn from other people's experiences. And I have a great videotape of asking some girls about swimming with sharks. And there's this one girl in the tape who says, you know, I've heard things about people who've been hurt by sharks and I've seen things. So it kind of scares me and her voice actually cracks. She's mm-hmm. like, but it could be interesting. And she says it could be interesting because the two girls before her said, well, it could be interesting if someone was with you, which P.S. was not part of the question. They added their own piece to it.
Someone was with you swimming with sharks.
And I'm just like, I still don't understand how that helps. But in their mind, it did. She clearly had this very visceral response based on abstract information. And if you watch the clip, she looks a little older. And I think she is a little older. And I think she has started to have internal experience. So when I tell you something that I've been through, and if I give you all of the right emotional cues, and if you're old enough and empathic enough to actually internalize what I'm telling you, you don't have to go through it. You just had an experience. Piaget, who I'm also a big believer in, Piaget said, you only learn through experience. And I believe that that's true. I just believe there comes a point in development when you can have internal abstract experiences that are as educational or as informative as actual experience. So the other classic example, and you probably are going to say, no, I would look, but is, you know, you have a box that's closed. And if I say to you, don't open the box or something really dangerous.
Definitely going to open it.
Yeah, most men are going to open it.
Called Pandora's box.
Yes, and we know what happens and it ends up okay, but the middle part's a little sketchy. but if I communicated the right facial expression and the right amount of visible fear and apprehension, you wouldn't have to do it. And the next time you saw that box, you'd be like, oh, no, I already know something about that. I know to stay away from that. You asked earlier about memory. Elizabeth Loftus has done some really cool stuff on the siblings.
We're going to have a ton of references on this discussion.
Siblings often share memory, so which is evolutionarily brilliant. So if you talk to people who have brothers and sisters, and I every year in intro psych I do this, and I always have at least one or two kids who now know that they did not break their arm when they were five. They were convinced their entire life that they did, and they were afraid of climbing on top of swing sets their entire life because of the time they broke their arm. And then finally their parents show them the medical records that it was their sibling, and they're like, oh, I could swear it was me. Which is brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant evolutionarily. So you have a kid who now doesn't have to have the same injury. If you think that happened
to
you.
It's interesting because memory isn't stored in the brain, and that when we then recall something, it sort of changes the memory.
Absolutely. And it was retold, you know, stories of family injury or things. And Loftus' study was about being lost in the mall. So convincing. So she found kids who had been separated from their parents at one point who also had a sibling, and she convinced the siblings that it happened to them. And it was very easy to convince them that it had happened to them because they'd heard the story so many times, and they had an apprehension about being lost because their siblings had been. And I think that's just, I think it's brilliant because it means that as you're growing up, you're adding to your collective experiences that are going to inform your decisions. So you don't have to have every single experience on your own.
But I imagine that if a sibling had trauma, it also could
absolutely impact
become shared trauma.
Almost always.
And if there's fear that dominates in a family, there will be a lack of learning from new experience.
Potentially. I mean, you also will get some kids who, as we were talking about temperament before, you also will get, you could get a wild card temperamentally in someone who's very bold, who comes out of a fearful family, but just isn't having any of it, is going to try things anyway, and they have to do it themselves, you know. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of genetics to basic temperament. But there's always a wild card in there. And then how parents interact with that and how schools interact, the field of epigenetics is fascinating. Right. And, you know, I love how much we're learning. And I think it's going to, in the next few years, teach us so much about how these things come to be. But you wouldn't want to have a little kid with a lifetime of experience, because then they'd never try anything new.
And it'd be impossible.
They'd also, you couldn't reason live with them. No, you also couldn't reason with them, because they'd be like, well, actually. So one of the other things that, I forget which memory researcher it is, but, you know, children are very suggestible. You know, they'll believe lots of stuff. It's really functional to believe there are monsters in the woods. It's, you know, it's hard to see our children scared, but would you rather have them wander into the woods or be afraid of wandering into the woods? So,
and the haunted house, too.
Very functional. Development happens the way that it happens, very intentionally. So adolescence is a practice time to become an adult. And it's this time when you become reproductively viable, so people start treating you differently. But theoretically, you get a year or so in most cultures. Here, we do the extended dance mix, and our adolescence lasts until
42.
Early 20. Yeah, exactly. So, but you need a little time to try out the adult world.
So some trends that are disturbing, actually, in terms of what you're saying. Children, males who stay at home in this generation where college graduates are not getting jobs and going home, that's a really bad thing for development, isn't it?
It kind of is. I mean, and, you know, it's interesting. So when I talk about sex and gender differences, and, you know, I try to sell the women in my classroom on a date with a guy who's in his 30s and is good looking and makes good money and is kind and funny, has an awesome car. Oh, and he lives in his mom's basement. Now, these are modern Vassar women, and they're like, yeah, no thanks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but he's helping his mom out. You know, he's got his own entrance, and the laundry's upstairs. And they're like, yeah, no, thanks. That's an evolutionary leftover. Guys are supposed to, we still have this somewhere in our being.
He doesn't have to get up and
go. Yeah, he didn't get up and go. He didn't go make his way. Now, this might change with the way, because there are other cultures in the world where, when children finish university, they come home. I shouldn't say children, young adults. When they finish university, they do come home, because why should you pay extra rent until you're ready to get married or move out on your own? So we could see a cultural shift over the next 10 years or so. But one of the other things that, again, speaks to this difference in the get up and go, the other example I love to use is a high school dance with people my age. And actually, even now, I ask Vassar women, okay, guys, remember high school dances. How many of you women asked a boy to dance? And out of a class of like 30, so we'll have probably 17 or 18 women in the room, usually two or three have asked. And were you ever refused? If they were refused, what happened? They're like, I went to the bathroom with all my friends, cried, left the dance, etc. So 14, 15 boys in the room, how many of you asked a girl to dance? Almost all of them. Any of you ever turned down? Almost all of them. Then what, if you were turned down by a girl and you asked her to dance, what did you do? Inevitably, one boy will say, well, ask your friend. And they all start crying. And if she said no, and then another guy will go, well, ask another girl. And someone else will, ask another girl. Ask another girl. And I'm like, thank you. That is why the human race has persisted. Because if you guys didn't keep just sitting in the gym being like, how, you want to dance? You want to dance? You know, because if it was up to the women, we'd be like, you don't want to dance with me? I'm going home. And so there are these little leftovers that are fascinating because, again, they're not deterministic. You know, there are plenty of girls who will ask men out, who will, you know, have no problem with that, who can handle rejection just fine. But boys have a biology, generally speaking, that predisposes them to be pretty insensitive to punishment. You know, if you want an adolescent boy to do something, don't punish him. That won't work. Set up a reward system for him. You know, figure out something he wants that'll make him look cool. And get them to work for it. Then you'll get the behavior you want. Unfortunately, girls, punishment and shame work.
I was thinking shame.
Yeah,
for all our listeners, that's the most important thing I think we learned in the last year. Thank you.
Well, and I think I'm glad that you picked up on shame, because guilt and shame are very, very different emotions. And guilt is a functional emotion. because it's usually related to a specific incident. Shaming is a very negative, wrong. Shaming usually indicts the whole person. And kids who feel shamed on a regular basis kind of give up. And so you don't want to shame children or adolescents. But girls are hypersensitive to shame. So you have to be very careful. But guilt is very effective with them. What girls are most afraid of generally is ostracism, is being left out, is being excluded, even by their parents. Even when they seem like they don't want their parents, they still want their parents' endorsement and support.
So that's the number two lesson we learned in the last year.
They do. If you don't have time for My So-Called Life, another movie, it's hard to watch.
Tell
but
about My So-Called Life.
Yeah, if there's anything that you want to know about adolescence, the whole thing can be told in about 40 minutes on Netflix. My So-Called Life, which is a series that was on in the 90s. Just watch the pilot. You know, you probably will get hooked and watch the whole series. It was only on for one season. But the pilot is fantastic. It has the parents' point of view. It has the kids' point of view. And there are so many quotable, I don't know anyone who won't identify with so many parts of it, both as parent and as adolescent. At one point in the beginning, she dyes her hair red. And her mother, her parents are talking about it. And her mom's like, I know she did it just to get to me. And the dad's like, maybe she just did it. She's like, no, she did it to get my attention. She did it to get a reaction from me. And he's like, well, don't react. And she's like, I'm not going to. I just... And then there's this long pause, and she says, just, it's so hard to look at her. She looks like a stranger, which is actually what's bothering her. It's bothering her that her daughter is changing. And it's not that she dyed her hair red. It's that she's changing, and that's hard for parents. And she doesn't look like a little girl anymore, and that's hard for parents, you know. And it's hard when your boy, who's always talked to you, stops talking, which, by the way, is how you know a boy is an adolescent, is they stop speaking.
It's to
usually,
you.
To anyone, really. Usually is accompanied with a baseball hat pulled down very far over their eyes and grumbles.
So in your presentation, you talked a lot about peer pressure and peer appeasal.
Mm-hmm.
And you're bringing that up now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, again, it's something that I think I have kind of a different take on than a lot of scientists. I think peer pressure is a wonderful thing. And he's one of the best, again, one of the greatest things evolution came up with. We don't really give enough credence to positive peer pressure. I think probably one of the reasons that a lot of kids end up in college is because all their friends are going to college.
Uh-huh.
And we don't talk about that. You know, we talk about peer pressure as a negative thing. And there are even scales in psychology, resistance to peer pressure. And people study resistance to peer pressure. And I actually think kids who are resistant to peer pressure are dysfunctional. Because you should, so another parental adage, you know, and I think they even use this in Montana, we'll have to check, but if all your friends jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, which again, to kids in Montana, they're probably like, what bridge?
But
the parents are like, it's a bridge. Would you jump off? And your parents want you to say, well, no, of course not. But the correct answer is, yes, you should. If all of your friends are on that bridge and all of your friends jump, there are two scenarios. There's a reason, like maybe there's a Bengal tiger on the bridge or there's a big train coming and your odds are better jumping. Or if you don't jump and they all do and any of them live, they're going to come back and reject you or possibly kill you. So if all your friends jump, yeah, you should jump. And that's a really hard thing for a lot of parents to think about. Now, if your child is spending a lot of time with people whose values are very different than your own,
right,
and that concerns you, saying, okay, you can hang out with those guys, but just don't do what they do. That's fighting evolution. You know, salmon swim upstream, but a lot of them don't make it. And the bears are sitting there to poach, and a lot of them don't make it. And I think fighting evolution is equally silly. So what do you do? Well, you figure out why they're hanging around with those kids. What is it that's so appealing about that peer group? And then you try to find something that's similar. You know, another peer group that's similar.
You try to reward them, I imagine, earlier statement.
Yep. So, you know, again, that goes back to what we were talking about before, about really listening. You have to really, really listen. You can't assume that you know from watching their behavior. You can't assume that it's like it was for you. Again, I'm a big fan of evolutionary psychology. We evolved to be in a one-room schoolhouse. One-room schoolhouses work really, really well.
Uh-huh.
And they save people, they save developing kids a lot of time because they watch the older kids screw up and learn. And
The sibling learning.
Yeah, it saves a lot of time. And the older kids mentor, and then the younger kids look up to them. And it's a small community, and it's well supported. you know, we did not evolve to have 40 kids of the same age sitting in chairs for 6 or 7 hours a day. So I think in doing that, you get kind of aberrant peer groups. If you're resisting peer pressure, then that means you're in the wrong peer group. Hmm. You know, your peer group should be on the same page. If I were trying to imagine being in my peer group in high school and being like, hey, would anyone like to go score some heroin? My friends would have just stared at me. Like, but my peers, it wouldn't have happened. Like, even if I somehow had gotten a hold of some drug like that and been like, hey, you guys, look, I have some heroin. They would have stared at me like, we don't do drugs. What are you doing? Like, that's dumb. We know that's dumb.
You know, that's actually a very interesting departure point, because we were speaking as we were coming over here about, we had a discussion with a young friend of ours about the legalization of marijuana. Mm-hmm. And being old, we were bringing up the cons to legalizing marijuana. We're not talking about decriminalizing or not, but, and we thought about your presentation actually about mm-hmm. how teens are very subject to peer pressure, and there's a portion of development where you really need to learn lessons. My mother used to say our lessons are the most expensive part of our lives.
She's right. Yep.
What do you
the
think?
The only thing that this young guy really agreed with was about teenagers, that they might not have the capacity to make the best decisions mm-hmm. about that.
Or well, if they have, like, marijuana at the end of the checkout lane, that you probably will buy it.
That the impulsivity.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm asked about, you know, teenage drug use a lot. I think when we talk about teenagers using drugs and alcohol, again, this is not necessarily the most appealing answer to people, but, you know, marijuana is not overly physically addictive. There are certainly drugs that are much more physically addictive. But it is psychologically addictive, because most kids who get into it and use it frequently are self-medicating for anxiety. And they're usually medicating for self, for social anxiety. Social anxiety is what makes you put clothes on before you leave the house. So you need a little bit of social anxiety, and that's what helps you pay attention in a situation and learn and be like, okay, I don't want to screw up, I don't want to screw up, I better pay attention.
I'm still going through that in the morning.
Yes. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, but I get stuck in my thinking about this, to be honest with you, because there are some kids who, if you could somehow magically titrate them and give them just a little bit, then maybe they'd actually be more socially successful, because they would relax just enough to interact and learn the lessons they need to learn. But I think the larger issue is you need to be present for life's lessons. And when you cloud the mind with anything, which is also why, you know, it's easiest to see with drugs and alcohol, but if kids also are having a really rough time at home, they're not learning their lessons with their peers, because they're too focused on what's happening at home. Mm-hmm. If they're struggling with a really debilitating learning disability, they're not learning their social lessons, because mm-hmm. their head is full of how do I get through school. So I certainly not equating drug use and learning disabilities. I just think that we underestimate the importance of social lessons that you really need to learn during those years, and how many things can interrupt or get in the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the impulsivity at that age, right? And then if you have genes, high-risk mm-hmm. genes, you're in trouble if you have a lot of access, because all of a sudden, that's an epigenetic phenomenon. All of a sudden, it's around more, right? And yep. that could very well, at a young age, turn the genes on.
We know from other research, the addicts, the earlier they hit their substance, the harder the treatment's going to be, you know, the earlier they start. And so if you can hold off running into whatever substance is going to kick off your disease, the longer you can
right.
hold that off, the better your treatment's likely to be. And again, I would argue that's because you have more social experience. You have more to lose. Right. You have a better perspective of, like, and again, like you're saying, if you have an addictive process that gets kicked off by exposure to the substance, it's going to be a very hard treatment course. The kids right. that I see in college who clearly are struggling with disease addiction, not abusing alcohol from stress or abusing alcohol from a variety of other reasons, but truly struggling with a disease, I feel for them, because to be 18 or 19 and find out that you can't go near alcohol is a really tough thing to deal with. And you're living in an environment with 2,000 other people that are, you know, probably half of whom are doing it on a regular basis. So one of the things about getting sober, any addict will tell you, you actually have to change your whole peer group. You will not get sober if you stay with the peer group you had, which is really hard
Very
if you're
difficult.
15 or 16 years old to say, oh, not only do you have this horrible disease that you're going to fight your whole life, but you now can't be friends with anyone you were friends with before. You can only be friends with people who, you know, don't use.
And who you thought were cool, too. You have
yeah.
to go with a
oh,
not
yeah.
cool group.
Right.
Works against two concepts.
Which is one of the reasons why a lot of the sort of outward bound programs and, you know, programs that the rehabilitation also has a lot to do with how to build good friendships and how to learn about how strong you are as a person and how much you are capable of and how much more you can do if you're sober. For young kids, those things work. They like right. that stuff.
They need that experience. So
right. And
they
a lot of it. And they may have started using because they didn't have it. You know, they wanted to have cool experiences and they weren't having cool experiences and they're bored and someone says, well, this is fun, as opposed to, you know, going rock climbing.
So what's the focus of what you're doing right now in terms of your research?
Well, like most scientists, I don't really have a focus. Oh, actually, that's not true. Most scientists have a good focus. there's a whole bunch of stuff we're working on. So still finishing up the decision-making stuff. And my real interest, honestly, my interest is in early adolescence, not as much in later adolescence, in like 11 to 15. That's not necessarily where the most pathology shows up, but I think that's where the first, not the very first, because I think there's a lot of indication that the big guns, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, a lot of stuff you see in young children. We just don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those children, we see that stuff and become completely typical adults. So it's a really tricky business to look at very young kids. But middle school and early high school is a time when so much is changing physically, metabolically, socially, all kinds of stuff.
Hormonally.
Yeah. And again, it's also the epigenetic stuff. So hormones flood the body, flood the brain, but you have a different brain than I do, so the same amount of hormone does two completely different things. Now I have to figure out how that intermingles with experience, and we have a big puzzle. So two things that we were looking at I think are kind of interesting that we need to do a little closer examination of. Well established in the literature that adolescent girls between 6th and 8th grade have a huge crash in self-esteem and anxiety goes up. And you were saying earlier, you know, they stop offering their opinions, they get very self-conscious, they get very self-critical. And so we had some measures of self-competence, feelings of self-worth and self-competence. And I had this relatively small group of girls in 8th grade that I had a whole bunch of behavioral data from 6th grade. And the only thing that predicted high feelings of self-worth in 8th grade was a measure called athletic competence, but it's actually, when you look at the questions that it asks, it's not about sports. It's feeling good about their bodies, which, given our culture, is not a surprising finding, but I think it's a little more than that, so I want to look at that, because I think if it is the case that instilling a lot of confidence in who you are, physically even, in 5th and 6th grade, helps stave off some of that hypercritical, hyper-self deprecation that happens in 7th and 8th grade, that would be really important to know. The other thing we're looking at is actually different social statuses. So being popular, being unpopular, being rejected or neglected. Our data and some data from some other labs are starting to say, you don't want to be popular in middle school. Peaking, you know, having your most popular years being in middle school, the most unhappy kids in my study are the quote-unquote popular kids. And there's a difference between being popular.
Wait, so they're popular and unhappy.
Miserable. Yep. And they feel picked on and they feel tremendous amounts of anxiety in certain areas and then abnormally low anxiety in other areas. So I think one of the reasons they're popular is that a lot of kids perceive them literally as being cool, as being kind of cold. That, you know, the stuff of adolescence is not getting to them. When in fact, actually, they're extremely anxious about other stuff. The kids who are, we find, are most well-adjusted are kids who are well-liked, which is different from being popular. So being well-liked, so being popular also has to do, traditionally in the social nomination literature, to be popular, they call it being controversial. And being
popular
is the same as being controversial.
Really?
And being controversial means you get lots of nominations from peers as being liked and nominations as being disliked. Now, How do you put that together and get popular? Well, these kids also have higher social influence scores and social impact scores than anybody else in the school. And when you ask students to list who are the popular kids, these are the names that come up. But when you ask them, who do you like, very often different names come up. Again, because the word popular to middle schoolers means they're socially in control. You know, they're the kids who decide what's cool and what's not cool. And that's what being popular is. So when we think of being well-liked by your peers is good and is very healthy, and those kids are healthy and happy and great. We're finding out some not surprising but interesting stuff about, particularly about rejected kids. You know, kids who are rejected have the same problems in middle school that they had in first grade. When you talk to first grade teachers, they have antisocial behaviors, they have trouble regulating their impulsivity, they come off as hostile. It's all the same stuff. So my guess is they probably were that way in first grade and didn't either were not able to because of their physiology or because of their experience, were not able to figure out how to regulate themselves. Like, being a poor self-regulator is the easiest way to not make friends, unfortunately.
That would be the bully.
No, that would actually be the rejected kid. The bullies are the popular kids, but they also, it's so fascinating. This is what I want to learn more about. So the kids who are doing the most bullying also report being bullied the most. Now, I'm not sure that that's accurate, but they feel that they are bullied the most. By their peers. And their peers would, most of the time, like, their mouths would hang open, like, really? But when you look more closely, a lot of times these kids, you know, people say things about the popular kids because they think they're untouchable. And it may be the case that actually it does bother them, but they don't show it because they look, again, they look very cool. They look very disaffected, disinterested.
I think I have to go back for therapy. I can't figure what it was that was my childhood.
Well, and again, I don't, you know, one of the reasons I love studying middle school is because I don't know that any of it's bad. Whenever I do interviews and people say, is there one thing you want people to know about teenagers or adolescents? I always have the same answer. It's not pathological.
Right.
You know, people have this assumption like, oh God, here comes adolescence. Oh God, oh God. It's, you know, it's not easy. There's a reason most people don't want to go back. And you don't want to go back because you had to learn a lot of stuff really, really, really fast. And when anyone has to learn a lot of stuff really, really fast, it's not fun.
And you have to learn painful things.
Yeah. Well, and you start developing a real social understanding of how other people work.
You know, as you're talking about all this, I'm thinking about what we call successful and what is well-adjusted. Well, okay, are these the kids who become managers in organizations, or how do you make a Bob Dylan or a T.S. Eliot? I mean, were they well-adjusted? Why would you want to? Right.
Or
well,
could, or can you? I don't know if you, I don't know if that's something that's made.
Well, I'm saying that if you interfere with the path of a child who seems perhaps to be an outsider or to not respond well to peers, they may become the people who become the poets and artists of the society.
Right. So that's why, again, I can't say enough. Listen to your children. Mm-hmm. You know your child. If you've put the time in as a parent to know your child, there's a big difference. Like, if you talk to most Vassar kids, and obviously I'm biased because I'm a Vassar grad and I teach here, and it is
the Vassar is a private college.
Yes, and it is the greatest institution in the country. Just make sure you get that in there.
Yeah, perhaps this was what was missing in my life.
That's the reason. If anyone listening has any question, it's because you didn't go to Vassar. But if you talk to most Vassar kids, most of us were quirky kids. But what's interesting is most of us would also say, like, no, I knew what the cool thing to do was. I just didn't want to do it. So I think if you have a child who's, like, on the fringe, who says, yeah, I know everyone's wearing that kind of jeans. I just don't want to wear them. I think that's cool. I would only be concerned if my kid has no idea what the popular jeans are, why anybody's wearing them, or why they should. That's concerning to me. Because you should be aware of the social norms of your middle school. You should know what is going on and what most kids are doing. And if you choose to not do it, great. But if you don't have a clue as to what that stuff is, that would concern me. Mm-hmm. So I think rejecting that stuff, you might get a Bob Dylan or a T.S. Eliot. And again, a parent who gets that, who's like, you look so weird, but I know you know what's going on, and I know this is a deliberate choice.
As I'm listening to you talk, that I again am being reminded of organizations and learning in organizations. I find it very interesting developmental model and how that could be applied to organizations.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that, regardless of the kind of organization, giving feedback, giving the appropriate feedback, which is what parents do for children and family members do, and sometimes community members, sometimes clergy members, whomever's around. Right, therapists. Whoever is around the child is constantly giving them feedback, sometimes too much. But I think in the business or organizational setting, giving people who are learning feedback and seeing how they make use of that feedback and can they make use of that feedback is really critical information, because that teaches you if they're capable of learning, at what rate are they capable of learning, and with what interest or what enthusiasm are they capable of learning.
Can they change?
Can they grow? You know, because you hear people talk about, you know, junior executives who will grow into their position, and a lot of them do with experience. Some of them don't, you know, so I think knowing what to look for, certainly developmental models have a lot to offer us, because we do know there are some kids, no matter how many times we give them the same lesson, it just doesn't stick. So that means they need to do something else with their time. We need to switch the lesson. We need to change the expectation. And, you know, or in the case of an organization, you may need to let someone go.
Or you have to change the reward structure instead of the punishment.
Which is exactly what my father studied, and he designed his company. It was called Management Reward Systems. And it was totally based on behaviorist ideas about reinforcements. Lisa Kudrow, who's a Vassar alum and a star of Friends, gave our commencement speech. One of the stars of Friends. She gave our commencement speech. And it is one of the greatest speeches I have ever heard, because it's basically all about failure until the very end, when you realize what a huge success story it is, because you can see failure as setback, and you can see failure as evidence that you're not good, or, and this is in the business model, or you can see it as I learned something from that. That's not where I meant to be. So she recounts a story, and I'm not taking anything away from watching it, because I promise you, you need to watch this. And it's on YouTube. It's very easily searchable. She was fired. She had finally gotten a job on a show that I knew was going to be a hit, because it was people who'd done Cheers. It was Jim Burrows. Like, it was going to be great. Frasier. She was hired to do Frasier. She walked onto the set and was fired the first day. And she was like, that's it. I'm done. And towards the end of her speech, she comes around to saying, thank God I got fired from Frasier. Because if I hadn't been fired, I would never have done Friends. And she said, and if I hadn't been fired from Frasier, I wouldn't have felt like I had nothing to lose and asked this guy out at a party who I've now been married to for 14 years, you know? And so she kind of rolls it all back into, like, you can look at these things as failures, or you can look at them as guideposts. Like, huh, I'm not really a good artist. Maybe I should try something else, you know? Like, and so I think within business models and within learning models, failure can be a learning experience. And right now, the way parents are setting up kids to be terrified of failure, I think is horrifying. I mean,
you're not alone in this concept. There's a big underswell about this. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It was very interesting.
Thank you very much for visiting.
Bye-bye.
So I hope you all enjoyed that. We'll have some material on The Deciding Mind. And now upcoming is Jackie and some cool music. And hold on to your seats.